Welcome back to Don't Miss a Beat. We are so excited. We're live at ESC Congress 2025 in sunny Madrid. And we are here with the man of the hour, Dr. Javed Butler, who is a dear friend and colleague, and together with my co-host, Dr. Steve Green. And we're here to discuss the VICTOR trial, which is in some ways the premier trial being presented here at ESC Congress. Dr. Butler needs no introduction and is also a repeat guest on Don't Miss a Beat. And he is president of Baylor Scott & White Research Institute and senior vice president of Baylor Scott & White Health. Javed, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Delighted to be here.
Super. So let's kick things off. VICTOR is a very, very unique trial. It's in some ways, a follow-up trial to the pivotal Victoria trial, but studied an adjacent population. And perhaps that's the biggest difference between Victoria and VICTOR, is that these patients were quite stable in ambulatory care. So can you just take us through what was the rationale for studying this fairly unique population of people remote from hospitalization for heart failure?
Yeah, indeed. So I just want to first sort of highlight the point that you made, that this is a unique population. If you look at most of the heart failure trials, they actually go the other way around. So even if they are not trials done in hospitalized patients or worsening heart failure patients, and they're general heart failure trial, they tend to enrich the patients with recent hospitalization or, you know, peri-discharge or something like that. Whereas here, not only was it not a study focusing on worsening heart failure, we systematically excluded the patients. So nobody who was hospitalized within the past 6 months was eligible to be enrolled or required outpatient IV diuretic on top of that, say, within the past 3 months or so. And the reason for that was that population with recent worsening heart failure, recent hospitalization within the past 6 months, or requiring outpatient IV diuretics within the past 3 months, was exactly the population that was studied in the Victoria trial. So we had the evidence there. What we wanted to do was to extend the evidence to the rest of the spectrum of heart failure with reduced ejection fraction patients. Now, what ended up happening, so that was sort of the rationale for this population, to go in a little bit more sort of ambulatory, stable population. But it did come to us a little bit as a surprise that we ended up getting even more stable population than what we would have anticipated, because even between 6 months and 12 months, hospitalization rate was only 14%. So 86% of the patients were never hospitalized or hospitalized in over a year ago. So really stable patient. And then obviously the baseline medical therapy was incredibly good. So all of these factors led us to enroll a population which is really ambulatory in a stable state.
Well, thanks, Javed. And you know, to catch our readers up and listeners up on where VeriSquat's been, so the Victoria trial that Javed just mentioned. So this was a positive clinical trial, we remember. It was a 10% relative risk reduction for the primary endpoint of CV death or heart failure hospitalization. And as Javed mentioned, that was an exclusively post-worsening heart failure patient population. But I think, you know, when people look at the composite there, you know, it was mostly driven by a benefit on heart failure hospitalization, not necessarily CV death. And then it was interesting to me, Javed, when you guys were designing VICTOR, you were powering this trial for CV death specifically, even though the primary endpoint was going to be the same as Victoria. So why don't you walk us through, you know, that rationale and, you know, why you guys decided that?
Yeah, so there were a couple of things that we learned from Victoria trial, right? So on one hand, I think we follow very strict frequentist rules of p-value and you know, alpha protection with hierarchy and all of those kind of things that I think we trialists love. But at the end of the day, the clinicians make decisions on the basis of clinical data and what they are seeing and what sort of makes some sort of clinical sense, biologic sense, and stuff like that. So for a second, taking off the statistical hat and putting on the clinician hat, what we saw in Victoria were two things. One, is that if you look at those patients in the lower three quartiles of NT-proBNP, which turned out to be about 5,300 or so, there was actually a cardiovascular mortality benefit. Now, granted, secondary analyses, and I understand that, but there was actually a cardiovascular mortality benefit, which sort of led to this hypothesis that maybe those people in the, you know, ambulatory outpatient setting, they have been discharged. Remember, even Victoria was not sort of, you know, ICU, inotropes kind of patient. They were also a post-discharge patient for the most part. That maybe when you have these ambulatory patients with NT-proBNP of 10, 11,000, that what they have is advanced heart failure, like they need LVAD, transplant, something like that. So maybe if we just come a little bit earlier in the trajectory, there could be cardiovascular mortality benefit. That was one thing. The second thing is that if you put some eye of faith, and again, this is just sort of, you know, clinical interpretation, that if you look at the curves in the Victoria trial, towards the end of the trial, they had started to separate. Now, that was such a high-risk population with a 37% annualized event rate that the follow-up in Victoria was really short, like only 10.8 months, not even 11 months. And the curve had just started separating. So the idea was that if we power the trial for cardiovascular mortality, if we have enough cardiovascular mortality event and we follow the patient long enough in a relatively less sicker population, that we will actually get to the answer to the question, whether CV mortality is reduced by variceguat or not. So that was sort of the rationale for the trial, the way it was designed.
You know, for the reasons you started with, that heart failure hospitalization tends to be a point of enrichment. It's often viewed that this type of trial design, in which you're enrolling a relatively stable, well-treated population, may be infeasible because the event rates are so low and that patients may need to be followed for too long of a duration. So can you speak to that? How long were patients followed in Victor? And were the event rates in line with expectations when you were initially designing the trial?
Yeah. So, you know, we made, obviously, like all trials, some estimates, but you actually, you know, are highlighting a really important point. Remember that, you know, in the 1980s, 90s, something like that, mortality used to be the primary endpoint. The reason why heart failure hospitalization and cardiovascular mortality became a composite endpoint is because of these feasibility issues, right? Because you want to enrich the trials, have some event, and have the relatively shorter duration of trial, duration. So most of these trials, if you look at it, even in stable heart failure patients that have focused on basically following the patients for, you know, year and a half, 18 months, 20 months, something like that. I don't offhand remember how long the average follow-up was, but it was in excess of 2 years. So we could expect that stable patient, it does take a little bit longer. Now, when I say that this was a more stable population, remember we at the end of the day did have NT-proBNP enrollment criteria. So there was some degree of enrichment anyways, and we did reach the targeted estimates for the endpoint, but the duration of follow-up was certainly longer than we have seen in other traditional trials.
And okay, Javed, so we know this was a very unique patient population. We know this was very well-treated patient population. Over 50% were on SGLT2 inhibitors. Over 50% were on ARNI. I think there was 40-something percent on quad therapy for HFrEF. So really, you know, our best test of could a novel or newer therapy be incremental to what, you know, the quad therapy standard is. So why don't you lay it on us now? So what are the results of the Victor study that you just presented for our audience? And how do you interpret them?
Yeah, the first answer is easier to give. How do you interpret? That's not that easy. So I can, we'll have some discussion about that. So the Victor trial did not reach its primary endpoint. The p-value was 0.22. There was a 7% reduction in the primary endpoint of cardiovascular death and heart failure hospitalization. Now, at the end of the day, you know, I'll most definitely sound a little defensive when I go over these results, because at the end of the day, you know, when we are making assumptions on the primary endpoint versus the secondary endpoints, it's a little bit of a dealer's choice, right? I mean, it's that there's no sort of particular reason to choose this versus that. We really wanted to have the primary endpoint and cardiovascular mortality be an equally important endpoint. That's why it was powered for it. And even the interim analysis rules and the you know, early closing rules, if it were to be positive and all that kind of stuff, were all targeted to getting the answer for cardiovascular mortality. So what was the interesting result is that if you break up this result, the components of the primary endpoint, we actually did not see an improvement in heart failure hospitalization, but there was a statistically significant benefit in cardiovascular mortality, in all-cause mortality and components of cardiovascular mortality. There was a significant reduction in heart failure-related death and in sudden cardiac death. All four of them were reduced. What's also interesting is that the prediction of mortality rate, when we predicted what, when we were estimating at the beginning of the trial, we met exactly the same mortality rate. So in other words, that sort of highlights the fact that even on this incredibly strong baseline medical therapy, stable patients, quote unquote, and the highest use of ICDs if you've seen in any trial, that the risk of mortality in HFrEF, the residual risk, is real. And in the fully powered trial with over 600 mortality events, we basically had mortality benefit across all of these four mortality outcomes.
Well, that is really impressive, and congratulations on completing the trial and really the interesting and important findings. So I am curious about, you know, this is a pattern of outcomes that we haven't traditionally seen with other classes of medical therapies in heart failure. And typically, these results are often driven by heart failure events with less robust or lukewarm findings on mortality, at least in contemporary care. And, you know, can you speak to that? My gut reaction, my gut reflection is that heart failure therapies should reduce heart failure events because they necessarily target pathways that improve overall heart failure disease progression. And heart failure hospitalization, at least we believe, is somewhat in the trajectory of heart failure disease progression. And prior to patients dying of a heart failure death, they may be hospitalized several times, or they may decompensate in different ways. And so how can a drug reduce, let's say, heart failure mortality or sudden death without necessarily having important effects on heart failure hospitalization?
So I'll geek out on you a little bit here, but remember you asked me the question. So there are two ways to interpret these results, right? So a lot of our colleagues will look at the results and will say that Victoria and Victor has exactly the opposite results, right? So on one trial was positive, but it's because of heart failure hospitalization. There was no mortality benefit. The other trial did not meet the primary endpoint, but is positive for mortality and not for hospitalization. And how does it even make sense? How does it make sense? So the first question is mortality result by chance, right? So that you did not reach your primary endpoint, and is it a chance finding, and do we believe in it? And I would say that the chance finding argument is relatively weak because, remember, again, this was not only a pre-specified secondary endpoint, the whole trial was powered for it. This is neither a surprise finding, it was hypothesis-driven, and it's over 600 events. It's not like, you know, 30, 40 events, and we just got that. So that doesn't make sense. I would posit, I've heard sort of some people in our steering committee who have discussed, who have just basically given the argument that maybe on quadruple therapy as well as it was given, that you have kind of sort of wiped out the risk of hospitalization, but mortality risk persists, and that's why we are seeing the difference. I am not sure I sort of agree with that argument as well. So here's at least the way I'm looking at it. The way I'm looking at it is that Victoria and Victor are basically exactly giving us the same result. The question is that we are catching people in the different part of their journey. So if you look at Victoria trial, you had hospitalization benefit because these people were sick and they were getting hospitalized. And then I already gave the explanation of what was happening with mortality. Now, if you look at the Victor trial, just think about it. If a person has never been hospitalized, we had close to 50% of the patients that were never hospitalized, and another about 35% of the patients were hospitalized over a year ago. So they are sort of the uber stable patient. When they start getting decompensated, what is the first thing you do? You change oral diuretics, right? You add a diuretic, you go up on the dose, you add the second diuretic. And we have plenty of literature that oral diuretic increases are associated with worse prognosis. So that has been very well documented in the heart failure literature. So what's going to happen in this particular population, that the first sign of worsening heart failure is actually oral medication change events, and then sort of IV and hospitalization, right? So that's the natural history. So now when we look at oral intensification related events in Victor trial, it is statistically significantly positive and very much consistent with the previous literature. Oral intensification in Victor is associated with a higher risk of mortality as well, either or also in Victor. So at least my interpretation is that we are catching people in different parts of their journey. Oral intensification was over 50% of the events in Victor, right? Over 50%. About 45% were hospitalization, 5% were about IV diuretic therapy. So if you look at the entire spectrum, and which, by the way, we have done in a pooled meta-analysis as well, pool analysis, which will also be published. If you look at the entire spectrum, and if you look at all worsening heart failure, hospitalization, outpatient, this, that, the other, I think it's trending in favor of vericiguat. And then if you pool everything together, the mortality is trending in vericiguat favor, especially so in people with NT-proBNP less than 6,000, which was the hypothesis that we posited and designed the trial specifically for less than 6,000. So that's the way at least I'm interpreting the data right now.
Yeah, and no, I've heard a lot of debate already about the Victor results and the interpretation, Javed, and I don't disagree with the way you're interpreting. I mean, I think the community understand that, you know, again, trial was powered for CV mortality, was thought about ahead. There was the NT-proBNP hypothesis that was talked about so many times with the Victoria in the study results that kind of impacted how you designed Victor. And it seemed to be a correct hypothesis, at least for the CV mortality component. You know, we're trying to, again, you highlighted that people are going to think about these are two different results, Victoria and Victor and everything. And I mean, some people have said, and I know you know where I stand on this, that, oh, it's maybe it's because that worsening heart failure is a totally different animal than the stable outpatient heart failure. And maybe that's why the exact same drug could have different results in these populations. What do you say to that? I know your meta-analysis really tried to look at the pooled group together.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that the absolute risks are certainly low.
Yeah.
There may be some yet undefined pathophysiologic changes in acute heart failure that may not be present in worsening heart failure. That's possible. And we need to understand that. But fundamentally, it is still sort of the same disease. And then when we look at the pooled analysis, even if you forget about the NT-proBNP business, you take the entire spectrum of NT-proBNP in the pooled analysis, all four of the endpoints, the composite of cardiovascular death, heart failure hospitalization, cardiovascular death, heart failure hospitalization by itself, and all-cause mortality, they are statistically significantly positive. Now, granted that the magnitude of benefit is modest, about 10% relative risk reduction, but it is statistically significantly positive. And then when we do the pooled analysis and focus on the 6,000, then as you might expect, not only is it statistically significant, but the hazard ratio improves further, about 15-17% reduction as well.
Great. And Samit, I want to have a follow-up question to that too. You know, for interpretation now, and you know, what the clinical community is going to talk about, it's going to be quintuple therapy. Is that the new standard of care? And, you know, on one hand, people are going to say, well, you know, Victor was a neutral trial, so how could that really get us to change our practice? But on the other hand, you know, we traditionally have talked about our class one HFrEF therapies as being, well, what separates them as class one? They're mortality reducing. You know, trials that are positive, like evabradine, for example, yes, positive trial, but didn't reduce mortality. They didn't meet that very high bar for getting class one now or class 2A. So you don't need to necessarily say what the guidelines are going to give for recommendation here, but we've normally put mortality reduction on a pedestal with HFrEF. And, you know, how do you think about now this technically neutral trial and that pedestal of mortality reducing therapies?
Yeah, I mean, it's more than technically neutral trial. Like, it's a neutral trial, right? I mean, yep. The primary endpoint was not met, for sure. You know, I mean, at some point, I wish I can go back 5 years and make mortality the primary endpoint and composite as the first secondary, and then it will be a positive endpoint, and you know, none of these discussions will occur. I mean, at the end of the day, I think it depends on sort of the composition, the orientation, the wisdom of the guideline writing committee and how they sort of look at it in a strict statistical sense. Then you know, you lose your alpha protection in a hierarchy. So you can technically say, well, it's a, you know, exploratory result. On the other hand, if you are either a Bayesian or if you're just plain old clinician doctor, mortality is the most important outcome. It's sort of the true north. Let me ask you a question the other way around. Suppose you were doing a clinical trial for, I don't know, like psoriasis or baldness or something like that, and the trial was wildly positive, right? You know, the psoriasis went away and you grew hair, you know, and everything is perfect. Primary endpoint met. But you had higher mortality. Would you ignore it? And it's not protected. It's not alpha protected. It's not even pre-specified. But there's higher mortality. Would you ignore it? And you'll say, it's just sort of, alpha, there's no hierarchical protection. I'm just going to give this drug, even if it kills the patient, right? I mean, you cannot ignore mortality. And especially when it is pre-specified, 80% power, and consistent, all four kinds of mortality, and more than 600 event, and clinically meaningful. So I don't know. I'm not on the guidelines committee. I don't know how they will think about it, but at least that's the way I'm thinking about it.
Can I ask you, so I am still struck by that heart failure events, even in Victoria, a population that is enriched for heart failure events, was modestly on a relative scale reduced. And then you see a fairly convincing, and I agree with you, a convincing reduction in mortality in this overall Victoria population, as well as in Victor. And so could it be that vericiguat is not a primary heart failure drug? Could it be that it is a drug that targets other systemic pathways of health that improve mortality indirectly, and that it, is favorable somewhat in heart failure for heart failure events, but the magnitude of benefit is much, much less for heart failure?
So your audiences who are watching this so far probably will say that, I'm hypothesizing a lot of things, and now you're pushing me into a completely speculative zone, but I'll go there with you. So it is possible, right? So if you think about sort of SGLT2 inhibitors, every specialty kind of look at it, it's a heart failure drug, it's a CKD drug, it's a diabetes drug. But I mean, you're having these systemic effects where sort of all of these organ systems are getting sort of benefit. And when it comes to soluble guanylate cyclase stimulators or activators, nitric oxide signaling pathway is ubiquitous, right? I mean, it's across many different enzyme systems. It's a cofactor for multiple organ system. And if you look at sort of, we already know that the drug works in pulmonary hypertension. We now are talking about heart failure. And I don't know whether you're aware or not, but there is, pretty good phase 2 data in chronic kidney disease and reduction in UACR with these drugs. So it is also possible that the benefit of these drugs is sort of systemic cardiovascular and other composite effects that may have more impact on mortality and not necessarily a traditional sort of congestion reducing heart failure effect. Now, this will go a little bit in the face of Victoria trial, and then we can have some sort of an alternate hypothesis. But I think it is really worth thinking about what you just said.
Javed, a very practical issue. So a lot of people in the community wonder, okay, this might have some overlapping pathway with ARNI. It really targets natriuretic peptides and that access in some way. And so can these drugs be combined easily? And do you have data from Victor that evaluated the subgroup of patients on ARNI?
Yes. So, when we did the subgroup analysis of ARNI in Victoria, one of the concerns was that there were very few patients on ARNI. In Victor, there are 59% of the population, so more than half the patients were on ARNI, and there was no difference in cardiovascular mortality, whether you are on ARNI or not on ARNI. So that did not make any difference. Then we have a simultaneous paper coming out that is focusing primarily on blood pressure effects and whether it is tolerated, and again, very well tolerated, similar to what we saw in Victoria. And now we are working on a specific paper focusing on GDMT per se. So the mortality benefit, whether you're on one drug, two drug, or three, four drugs, made no difference in mortality. And when you look at specific drugs, or ICD for that matter, the mortality was seen across all of these subgroups.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that's very helpful to know, Javed. Very consistent with what we've talked about in the past, that every time we get a positive trial with a new therapy, it does seem to be additive, that it makes no difference in terms of relative risk reduction, whether you're on, you said, one, two, three, et cetera, prior medicines. But with that, I think that's all the time we have for this episode of Don't Miss a Beat. Javed, really want to thank you for joining us today, and get big congrats to you and all your investigators for Victor and the Victory meta-analysis. So with that, we really want to thank our audience as well for tuning in. You can catch this episode and all prior episodes on hcplive.com, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We'll see you next time on Don't Miss a Beat.